from this activity of offering spiritual sacrifice, a spiritual sacrifice to God, which we get to do as a holy priesthood. We found out a little bit earlier in 1 Peter 2. And then to the setting of what we usually refer to as secular responsibility. The Bible doesn't make the big distinction between the spiritual and secular that we do sometimes in our thinking. But what's the hardest thing for you about taking your faith with you into those other settings? If you had to name one challenge that you face, what would it be, Dave?
Whenever I was working, we were always seemed like we were always busy with our daily lives, and most times we didn't stop to take the time to thank the Lord.
All right, just taking the time to be grateful in the middle of the hectic schedule and the busyness and all of that of everyday life. Anything else you can think of? Anyone have a different challenge? Jan?
Sometimes it's hard when you're working and you're around people that don't believe like you do.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing and saying things. How do you be part of a team or a group and yet not condone what they're doing?
Right. How can you be unassuming enough about the faith that you're committed to so that you are living it in the presence of people who don't share those convictions without trying to make a show of it? Can I say it that way? All right, that's a challenge. Anybody else? Okay, well, that would be one of the things, the relationships, I'll say it that way.
The transition from we want spiritual comfort surrounded by spiritual people here, spiritual finding, but then when you get out of this, I get out of this area, we go back into the physical world, where you tend to want to maintain it, not as well as we do have spiritual finding.
Okay, I think of sometimes of the challenge of consistency, being the same person in both settings, being the same individual, living by the same standard, living with the same hope, I think is a part of it. Okay, Chris? All right. I think that's an interesting and a thought-provoking point. It's something that Peter deals with here. To say it this way, taking in stride everyday life, which is sometimes has in it things that are shocking, disappointing, and not right, and so forth. I think that's a part of it. Coping with, take it in stride and not being surprised. But Peter's going to bring that up over in chapter 4 about the difference. Okay, Tiffany? All right, have you guys thought about that? A lot of our people are involved in the field of education in one way or another, and so when you're expected to abide by policies that are imposed on you that you don't share, that and sometimes you perceive as contradictory to what your convictions are. All right. All right. I hope you can hear what she's saying. Becky says that she feels unconditional love in the church around her brothers and sisters, and then she goes to the world. She doesn't feel that. How many of you can identify with that. You can't drive down Glenstone and feel that. Okay, yeah. All right. Just like. All right. So not falling into the same, when it's complete habit all the time. All right. So resisting the pressure to conform to it without even thinking about it is a big part of that. Maybe that's enough to illustrate something that I think all of us already know. We have challenges in this way. So in 1 Peter 2 and following, Peter is now dealing with things that happen at first sight, it seems to be in the work world, but it also sort of spills over into the household world. I think both settings are thought about beginning in verses 18 and following. How many of you have ever heard of Charles Sheldon's book by this title here, 100 Years Ago? Charles Sheldon wrote a little book entitled, you know about it? Okay, Byron knows about it. Sheldon's little book, he wrote a book assuming the premise that a group of Christians in the community commit themselves to taking the Sermon on the Mount and practicing literally what Jesus taught in everyday life, and he focused on what an upheaval that caused in community life, and how much it changed in business and work and school and neighborhood and everything else, and it got to where things couldn't go on as they always had with people doing that. Well, Peter kind of takes that idea here. Only he's thinking of it not in terms of how do you impact the world, but in terms of how do you display the excellence of God in the world. And last week we began a list here that I don't want to return to the whole list, but I would like to share with you a comment I found about verses 18 and following here, and I think this kind of explains the outlook of this passage that we're going to be reading here. This writer observes the general emphasis throughout this section is on active and patient submission, on loyal and disciplined devotion, freely rendered, constrained by reverence for God, and inspired by constant confidence in Him. So, in other words, the tone of this passage is not dread or fear of what people will think or what might happen to you in the world. It's reverence for God and confidence in what He's done through Christ. And this writer makes the point that this passage generally shows that the way to please God is not to rebel against the world, but to serve His will in the world. And he says, summing it up, Christians should be God-fearing, loyal and obedient citizens, considerate neighbors, diligent and faithful employees, uncomplaining victims of unjust treatment, dutiful and devoted wives or husbands, sympathetic and general and personal relations, using every opportunity actively to forsake evil and to do good. No big deal, right? I want you to notice that the idea of reverence for God and confidence in what He's done through Jesus is key to this whole idea. So now then at verse 18, notice that we take up here, and let me read two or three verses. in the beginning of this. This verse 18, servants, now remember, in their economy at the time, servants, either voluntary or otherwise, lived in households often and worked at the instruction of what this will call their masters. It would not be, generally speaking, the kind of racial slavery that existed in the history of our country, although that did happen in some cases in the Roman world to conquered states or regions. And although often the treatment imposed by masters was disgustingly harsh, as you might notice as we go along here, and I just mentioned that the tone of Peter changes a little from this passage to what we find at the end of chapter 3. Here, where he's talking about what Christians do, he speaks of it in one way, and he uses the cross of Christ as his example. Over there, when he's dealing with injustice or unjust behavior imposed by those in power, he uses the resurrection of Christ as Christians' examples, and then the thought of judgment. So here we have, servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are harsh. For this finds favor, if for the sake of conscience toward God, a person endures voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not with greed or eagerness, I've skipped a page here. A person endures grief when suffering unjustly, for what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? But if when you do right and suffer for it patiently, you endure it, this finds favor with God. All right, now on my reading of that, even though I messed it up, what would stand out to you as the biggest difference between how a Christian is going to function in settings like this and someone who is not a Christian might function in a setting like this? What, just in general first impression, what's the biggest difference? Julie? All right, that would be... All right. Any of you summarize it in any different way from that? Anybody? My first thought is, as I read this, anybody can do good when it is appreciated and responded to, and when he's thanked for it, and when he's honored for it. The Christian, however, is someone who can do good, and even when he is harshly treated for it, he still can persist in so doing and endure it. And what would be the reason? What's the motive? The different motivation between the two? All right. One is finding fulfillment in imitating Jesus, and the other is doing it for either a have to or for what he expects to be rewarded by in that process. So let's look at it a little more carefully now. One thing to notice is that this paragraph has something in common with the previous one. You notice it in verse 19, and it is, you do this for the sake of conscience, or for the sake of conscience, especially toward God. Please notice that. Now, the ESV translates this, if if you do it, if you're mindful of God. But if for the sake of conscience toward God, that's the key idea here. So what is happening is that here is a person who is taking what he believes about God, what he knows about God, what he understands about what God has done for him, and most importantly, he's taking his understanding of who he is in relation to God into an ordinary, normal function in everyday life. That is, the boss he serves, or the work he does, or the role he has in the economic situation of everyday life, or the household situation. Now notice that this has in common the motive with what Peter has already written about responding to the civil authorities. You notice up here in verse 13, he said, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution. You notice that? So in each case, the reason is higher, the motive is higher than the responsible action is. Does that make sense? The motive is higher than who the civil authority is or how the master is conducting himself. It's done for the sake of God. Now, if the servant is deciding what the motive is, where does that place the servant in relation to the master? All right, the servant is determining his own the plane on which he lives. The master can tell him what to do, but the servant is deciding why he does it. So that means that this will be a voluntary action in that sense. The servant is not simply being forced. Generally speaking, when you are forced to do something, you're made to do something, you have no choice in doing it, a threat is held over you. How does that make you feel? What's your attitude generally about that?
Reluctant.
All right, reluctant might be one word for it.
Angry.
All right, reluctance quickly turns into resentment, anger over it. You don't like to be forced. That started when I was a kid and Mom made me do this or that chore. I could do it, but I would choose my mood in so doing. And you know where the rest of that story leads. So that's the first thing to notice about this. Now, that's the motive. What's the tone which the servant of the Lord takes in his service to others in everyday life? Pardon? All right, a pleasant tone. What's the word used in the text here? With all respect. And I'm using the New American Standard translation of this here. And this is verse 18. Be subject to your masters with all respect. Now, what attitude shows toward God normally in Peter's language here? What did he tell us to do toward God in verse 17? All right, to fear God, reverence God. So toward God, there is reverence. Toward the authority you deal with in everyday life, there's respect. Is there a difference? You reverence who God is. You respect the role that the person has in your life. They're two different things. Now, toward which masters does the Christian respond for the sake of conscience toward God with all respect? All right, so look at the way Peter says, both The gentle, first of all, what do you think of with the gentle master that you have to deal with? Have you had ever had a boss who was gentle? I think I had some of both. Believe it or not, I did things before I was a preacher. And I worked in the sawmill. I worked as a laborer for a bricklayer. I worked in a factory that made electric motors. I worked as a butcher, the meat processor for Lubbock Christian University. And I worked as a tractor driver driving a bush hog all summer. I had all kinds of bosses. They weren't all nice. But generally, I found out that they were just trying to make it. And if I tried my best to do my job, one of the best compliments I ever got was when I was working for a bricklayer, a masonry company one summer, mixing the mud and so forth. And I was in college, and I overheard some guys talking at a coffee break. And I heard one guy say to the other, "He's one of the best laborers we've had, and he's going to make a preacher." Like it was just unbelievable that there would be such a waste. I didn't tell him that was also a pretty good motive to be a preacher. You guys who've done that work understand. And I'm only kidding, of course. But that's the idea, both to the gentle, but also to what else?
Harsh.
And the harsh. What does that mean?
Opposite of gentle.
Opposite of gentle. In every way, the opposite of gentle. Someone who maybe has the angry, mean, selfish, unappreciative, disrespectful tone. Can you respect the disrespectful? That's kind of what some of you were talking about in making the transition into everyday life. And again, you're doing this for whose favor? All right, you do this for the sake of conscience toward God, but also for God's favor. Meaning what? Who are you really trying to please? God. Who really will end up being the one who rewards you for your... The master can reward you for your work. Hopefully he'll pay you or something else. In their world, it meant room and board and all that kind of thing. But who can reward you? God can. And so this takes a picture of work and everyday life that rises above simply survival, and it gives an honor and a dignity to it that is above the ordinary. So I think that picture of work is an important one. So, and what finds favor is if a person, for the sake of his conscience toward God, endures grief when suffering unjustly. All right, so I'm going to put here, endures injustice. In this setting now, in this particular setting that we're talking about, has anybody in this room ever had a day or a week when you felt like you've been treated unfairly by the person you were working for? I'm not going to ask you to explain or to call names, but have you? Now, some of us haven't had it happen really bad, you know. Most of us have had choices that we could have made in most of the situation. We didn't have to stay in that role, in that job. These were people who might not have had that opportunity or that privilege. They might have been stuck in this situation. And notice the idea, does the Christian have to say, yeah, that's fair, it's fine, it's you treat me however you want to. Does a Christian have to say that? Does this rule out, for example, we just read about the place that we have in the community and that the authorities who have power in human institutions are placed there for by God for the punishment of evildoers and praise for those who do right. So does what this asks of us as Christians forbid the exercise of civil rights in the role that we have in work or other places? Does this forbid me to make use of the legal process in order to uphold my place in the world? No, it doesn't. This is talking about how I respond to the person myself or to the person himself in everyday life. So it's important to remember that verses 13 and following come before this, but the idea here is my attitude when this happens to me and my behavior. So it's no credit in anybody, he says in verse 20, can do right when he's treated well for it. But a Christian can do right even and endure even if he's not treated well for it. And then verse 20 makes the point that there is no credit in sinning when you are harshly treated for it. What you want to do is try to endure with patience, and you want to make sure that any of the injustice that happens is not brought on by sin in your life, in your behavior, in your conduct. And there's the challenge in this process. But if when you do right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. A phrase that I hear used in public discussion quite a bit right now is this one here: do the next right thing. Have you heard that? Maybe it's just a phrase that teachers use to students or coaches use to players or something like that. I don't know. But it's pretty much what the advice that Peter gives here: do the next right thing. And in that way, you'll be following the example of Jesus in everyday life. So that leads Peter now to the kind of the core of his whole discussion in verses 21 through following here. And this is the motive for both of the other things, both of the other relationships he's talked about, which would be community and workplace or work situation, and then the ones that follow, which would be family and church. He says, "For you have been called for this purpose, because Christ also suffered for you." So this becomes now not the thing that's separate from our relationship to Christ, but the purpose of it. God has a people for his own possession so that there can be people who can go into these roles in everyday life and show his work and not the evil ones were. "Because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his footsteps." The word for example is like the little way we used to teach our children to write. You have one line up here and then you have this other line underneath that has this line and these dotted lines in between, and then they copy and the line underneath, the letters that were written up there. Here is Christ, and we're trying to copy him. And you notice our little kids their first efforts at this are not very perfect, but they get better, and then they get become habit, and then they become their handwriting. And that's kind of the way this is calling us to lead. So walk in his footsteps. And then the quotes that are drawn, this is just an exposition of Isaiah 53. He who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth, and while being abusively insulted, he did not insult in return. While suffering, he did not threaten, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. So that part of this needs to be woven through our thinking about this passage here. Not just the suffering, but he was choosing to entrust himself to the one who judges righteously. And he himself brought our sins, or brought our sins in his body on the cross, or bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that we might die to sin and live for righteousness. By his wounds you were healed. For you were continually straying like sheep, but now have returned to the shepherd and overseer, or guardian, or bishop of your souls. We'll return to this text some next week. But for now, notice that Peter is making the point that in the way Jesus conducted himself in the face of insults and threats and suffering, somehow contributed to the redemptive purpose that his work on the cross served. Is he saying that somehow our reflecting this example in everyday life somehow contributes to God's redemptive work, somehow embodies the example of Christ in real life every day, so that the way of God can be seen in the world, or can be observed in the world? That's a thought-provoking part of this. So it can't just be Christ not responding to insults, or Christ suffering that's involved, because Peter's point is that while suffering and committing himself to God who judges righteously, Christ accomplished something that could not have been accomplished in every way. He became a healing presence in the history of mankind. By his wounds you were healed. And he becomes the great shepherd and overseer of our souls in that way. And it's in returning to him now and following him that way of God is reproduced in the midst of a world that does not at all have that approach to things. I'm trying to illustrate that this, what Peter is saying here, just to servants about work in everyday life, is much more revolutionary in its nature than we could expect, that we might realize. And I'm asking us to think about how the world right now is trying to go about correcting injustices, real or perceived, whether it's working, and how different it is from the ways of God. Now it would be, let's throw the masters out. Let's all rise up against them and show them who's who and what's what and get ours. It would be a power play. It would provoke another insult or response or problem in return. And it would not make near the difference in the long term that this right here would. It's a thought-provoking thing. I hope you'll give some thought to it this week. Thanks again for being with us for our class today. We'll get ready for our assembly now. Make yourself at home, and I hope you have a great week.